We are on page 10 is what I have. Does anybody need notes? Page 10? Nobody does. All right. So as we've been working through this first, what is often called the missionary journey, it sounds like it's a tour. It's not, right? And missionary, I think, is an extremely vague word. I think it's more helpful to look upon it as either an evangelistic journey or as a church planting endeavor. Missionary is just vague. What do you mean by missionary? And I think it's Paul was not there just to help them dig wells and raise cattle and learn how to be better farmers, right? Which is, I know guys who have been called to agricultural missionary work. And it's like, well, that's nice. You could do that with Peace Corps, right? Is that still a thing? But, you know, you're not there to help them be better farmers. Though you could do that as part of your church planting, right? Paul made tents. He made awnings for businesses, right? In Corinth, we know that, in other places as well. But that wasn't his thing. That he did that so he wouldn't have to take money from the churches, right? He was self-supporting in that regard, though the churches, some did help. But Paul was not there just to travel and sightsee. One missionary said he chose the location of his ministry as a missionary because they had good fishing. I think, well, that might be true that they do have good fishing. And it might be true that's why you chose the location that you did. But I think that's extremely short-sighted and self-centered, personally. But we're not there just to do those things. Missionaries, as we call them, are supposed to be church planters, right? To establish churches, self-sufficient, if you will, self-governing, self-supporting, self-replicating churches that can function in their particular region. Now, having said all that, Paul's first journey comes to an end in verses 24 through 28. And I want to spend some time on this because I think we sometimes miss out some significant things. So first of all, in verses 24 and 25, it says, when they had passed through Pisidia, they came into Pamphylia. And again, go back and look at your map. All they're doing is retracing their steps, right? They went to point A, B, C, and D, and now they're coming back to D, C, B, and A. That's all they're doing. They came back, and when they had spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. So in other words, they went back to the seaport. Right? That's all they've done. They've done their long walking, and they have come back. They speak the word in Perga, which they had not done earlier. If you go back and look at chapter 13, they didn't spend a lot of time there. But now, apparently, is the time, right? So you don't have to hit every town. And again, you don't have to, and we have to be careful with this, but there are some who are engaged in evangelism, who have perhaps great zeal for evangelism, but they try to guilt you into certain behaviors, okay, and certain expectations. So from what some of these men have said, if you don't speak to every last person or you don't go into every town, then those people are going to die and go to hell, and it's your fault. Well, that's not how the Apostle Paul functioned. He went strategically. He went to certain locations and he communicated biblical truth in certain spots, but he did not in others. However, there were other times, as in Perga, he came back and then at that time communicated biblical truth. Now, were there people who could have died and gone to hell in Perga in between the time Paul was first there and the time he came back? Probably. Okay. But it was strategically important for Paul to get where he needed to get to and then to come back in a timely manner and then communicate biblical truth. So, yes, we should be concerned about the souls of people. Yes, we should be concerned about sharing the gospel. But at the same time, don't let people's stories or other people's expectations guilt you into things. You don't want guilt-based evangelism, right? Shouldn't evangelism be motivated by love and the glory of God? So balance that out. So Paul comes to Perga and communicates the word of God at just the right time, okay? And that might not fit in everybody else's agenda, but it was right. So they then hop on the boat and they're going to head back all the way over to Syrian Antioch. Look at that in verse 26. And from there they sailed to Antioch. Now, we know that that's got to be Antioch of Syria because they've already went past Antioch of Pisidia. So this Antioch, which is arguably one of the top, in the top five cities in the entire Roman Empire, doesn't have to be called Antioch of Syria because everybody knows it's Antioch, right? It's just, it's like we do in Minnesota, right? You're going to go to the cities, and if you deal with people from out of state, they go, which ones, right? And they go, where do you mean? Well, the cities, right? The twin cities. Well, what do you mean the twin city? We'll just go to Minneapolis, okay? And that's kind of the way Antioch was. It was such a significant city. But notice how Luke describes this. They have sailed this 300 miles from Italia to Antioch. They have now traveled almost 1,400 miles. They have been gone for about a year. Now notice what it says, and they came back to Antioch from where they had been committed to the grace of God for the work that they had fulfilled. So they accomplished what God had sent them out to do. Now, what that tells me is stopping in Perga to communicate the word of God on the return trip is part of fulfilling the work that they had been sent out to do. And not sharing the word the first time through Perga was also part of fulfilling the work that they had been called to do. But notice they came back and they communicate to the church. And notice what it says. And when they had arrived and gathered the church together. Now, how can they do that? They're just Paul and Barnabas, right? But what were they in chapter 13? They were leaders in the church. That hasn't changed any. They have just been leaders who have been gone for a year. But they still possess the authority and apparently the respect because the rest of the congregation says, okay, right? They gather because Paul and Barnabas said to gather. So they come back and they arrived and gathered the church together and began to report all the things that God had done with them and how he, God, had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. So do you recognize that they gathered in order to communicate, because they're demonstrating submissive accountability to the congregation, right? The church is who sent them out. This was just not something like, well, I just feel led to go to these places. Could you send me some money? Okay? Which is American missionary work, right? I get emails or phone calls, not every week, but a couple times a month, begging for money. You know, God has called me to be a missionary to wherever. Occasionally, they talk about a church that they're a part of that is actually sending them, but oftentimes it's just this rugged American individualism. Okay? No authority over them, no submission on their part. Now notice, they reported everything that God had done with them, and I've typed in a few things here. God the Spirit, I tried to break this up according to the Trinity. God the Spirit had called them to this work, which included some really exciting things, walking and sailing. Can you sail to the glory of God? Yeah. Can you walk to the glory of God? Can you contact strangers to the glory of God? Can you speak with different ethnic groups? Explain God's word, disciple new believers, react to opposition and persecution, establish congregations. Well, now we're getting to more exciting things, right? Like the really spiritually things, right? But you understand what I'm trying to say here, right? These are significant things, all of these, because if you don't walk, you're not going to get there. And if you don't sail, you're not going to get there. See, all of these things are part of what the Spirit of God has called them to do, to appoint congregational leadership. This is all part of what they did. Some are more glamorous, some are less glamorous. It's not quite as much fun to sail and to walk as it is to establish a new church. Right? But you need to do all of those things. God the Father's grace sustained them. And Luke says that God the Father did these things with them, and God the Father opened the door for them. So you get the impression, and I think it's helpful if we can, it's an age-old diagram, right, of the triangle of the Trinity, but God the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit have, they are equal in essence, equal in attributes, equal in glory, equal in all areas. But they have different jobs, right? And God the Father is the one who has, if you will, who oversees this and is the architect, if you will, of all of this. God the Spirit is the one who is implementing and calling Paul and Barnabas to this specific aspect of ministry under the authority of God the Father. And this, that doesn't mean the Spirit is less than the Father any more than it means that the Son is less than the Father. They have different jobs. It is Jesus who says, "What I always do those things that please the Father," right? He doesn't say, "I always do those things that please me." He's very clear that there is a hierarchy of responsibility within the Trinity, but there is equality of essence and equality of glory. And there's no minimization, there is no dishonor in the Son or the Spirit doing the will of the Father. But the Father is the one who is the top, if you will, designer or architect of this. So God the Spirit has called them, God the Father has opened doors for them, and God the Son has already foretold this ministry, that you are going to go into the remotest parts of the earth. Jesus already told them that. Now how did he know that? Because of the Father's eternal decisions, eternal purpose. God the Son was the focal point of the message that the Gentiles trusted, right? They believed the gospel. So all three persons of the triunity of God are involved in this, and so Paul and Barnabas are explaining to the congregation, notice how they worded it, all things that God had done with them. Notice it does not say all the things that we have done for God. Significant difference. Okay, this is not a glorification of Paul and Barnabas. This is a glorification of God. Okay, and it's, well, it doesn't really matter how you word it. Yeah, it does, right? Because God does not share his glory, Isaiah tells us, right, with anybody. So if these people, if these missionaries are trying to bring glory to themselves, then shame on them. But Paul doesn't do that. Paul and Barnabas say, this is what God has done with us and how God has opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. He doesn't say, boy, I preached a really good sermon. You should have seen how many people came. Paul doesn't say, boy, that outline really preached. Okay? And I've heard pastors and evangelists say that. And I got this outline that God has really blessed. Well, or else you're just really effective communicator of a particular outline. But it's how you word it. You want to glorify your outline? Glorify your sermon? Glorify the messenger? Or you can glorify God, right? There's the difference. So Paul and Barnabas give them a Godward report. They've called them together, and I know they've been gone for a year, right? That's a long time, right? And they come back. Can you imagine that gathering, you know, of the other the men who had been on the ministry back in chapter 13? I'm going to get the names wrong. Chapter 13 and verse 1. So Barnabas has gone with Paul. Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. So these other three guys, Simeon, Lucius, and Manaen, they've been handling things back in Antioch of Syria without Paul and Barnabas for the last year. Now, it's the old expression, borrowed from, who was the philosopher? Was it Herodotus? There's a Greek philosopher who said the same man never steps into the same river twice, right? Because he's a different man and the river is different than it was last time. And my paraphrase of that is the same pastor never shepherds the same congregation twice. Right? The shepherd's different and the congregation's different. Right? So Paul and Barnabas come back. They've been gone for a whole year. They're not the same. Right? Paul comes back. Perhaps, again, we don't know the time frame exactly here, but how long has it been since Paul had been drug out of the city supposing to be dead? Okay, so Paul comes back and Simeon and Manaen and Lucius look at him and go, Paul, what happened there? Right, Paul, you're limping. Yeah. Well, let's share some stories. Okay. Now, these other three men did not undergo all of those things. They've been dealing with believers in Antioch. They're different, right? The church has grown. Maybe the church has shrunk a little. Some people have died, some people have moved away, maybe some new people have come. And so Paul and Barnabas need to be introduced to the newbies, right? To the new members class, right? And the church, whoever, the new people need to understand that, oh, Paul and Barnabas are part, these are the ones we've been praying for the last year. Right? Now I can put a face with that name thing, right? So can you imagine this gathering? I mean, what a tremendous time. And if Paul and Barnabas have come back and said, boy, we really did a number over there. You should have seen us, you know, and made it all about them, you know, put their PowerPoint together and had all these pictures of Barnabas with a wheat field in the background and a sunset picture, right? But if they had come back and did this glorification of the servant thing, you know, how are these new believers in Antioch going to respond to that? Right? But they come back and say, here's what God has done. Here's how God has opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. Okay? So what a meeting this must have been. And then it says, the last there in verse 28, it says, and they spent, Luke's writing, and they spent not a little time with the disciples, which is another way of saying they spent some time, right? A longer time, but not a little time. It's just an expression, but it seems to have been, if my calculations are correct, somewhere between 1 and 2 years there. They were gone a year, and now they'll be back for about a year to get adjusted. And you have all of those things, right? All of the time zone things and all of the, maybe it's healing up. Yeah, maybe it gives time for Paul to really take some time off the way the doctor told him to, right, so to speak, and to rest up and to just to regroup. And it's been all these things we've looked at, right, in the first 9 pages of our outline, right, in these last 2 chapters of the book of Acts. That's a lot of stuff to happen. And so they come back and they spend not a little time with them. Now, number 4, at the very bottom of my notes there, the sending congregation benefits by sending out the ministry team and by hearing all that God does through that team to the glory of his name. Now, again, people being people, so Paul and Barnabas are chosen by the Spirit of God, and the church recognizes that, sends them out. And I just go to work every day. That's all I do. You know, I'm not Paul. I'm not Barnabas. I'm not doing anything for God. You know, and that's people. And there's that temptation. And we should give honor to whom honor is due, but sometimes we take certain Christian responsibilities and elevate them to a point where the person who just goes to work every day, right? Isn't that really what happened with during the time of the Reformation? Was to do away with the Catholic concept of secular and sacred, and was to say that you, Luther and others of the Reformation, you bake bread to the glory of God. You paint pictures to the glory of God, right? And this is where, if you look at the artwork of that time frame, how the realism that came into being more so, I think, during the Reformation, and the subjects of what they painted. You know, the people, two ladies together, one lady combing another lady's hair. I think, well, what's so exciting about that? Nothing. But you do it to the glory of God, because whether you eat or drink or whatever you do all to the glory of God. So what that does is elevate combing hair, right? Or baking bread, or carving wood, right? Or whatever it is you do, making bricks, or building a building, or being an accountant. All of those things during the Reformation began to matter, because the reformers said, everything you do is to be to the glory of God. So you stay back home, you stay in Antioch, and maybe you raise sheep. Well, then raise sheep to the glory of God, right? And you can pray while you're doing it. You don't have to be Paul and Barnabas. But you're just as important in the mind of God. You're praying, you're seeking to glorify God in your responsibilities. And as you contribute financially to the congregation, then that helps replenish the funds that were spent to help Paul and Barnabas when they first left in chapter 13. That's to the glory of God, right? So don't minimize what it is you're doing and somehow say, well, I'm not doing anything. You're praying, right? And you're encouraging, and you're demonstrating faithfulness to my brain this morning, to Manaen and Simeon and Lucius, they need to be encouraged because Paul and Barnabas have left, and now we've lost, what does that come out to? 40% of our church leadership team. Right? We sent away 40% of our leaders. And what that means is then that these other three guys need to pick up that slack, right? You lose 40% of your workforce, right? Somebody's got to do what they were doing. So encourage them and help them and minister to them. So all of this comes together in such a way that God is glorified both by those who were sent out and who returned, but also by those who stayed. And they want to know that Paul and Barnabas did what we sent them out to do. Now, the Spirit of God called them to that particular ministry, and now we want to know what that was. Because you are accountable to us. So, not in an authoritarian way or in some congregational dictatorial way, but in a way that we're concerned, but we also want to hold you accountable. And we want to learn. We want to know what God has done. So all of that comes together, and it is approximately at this time that James writes his letter, and it is possible that the Apostle Paul writes the book of Galatians about this time. Now, on your map, let's see here if you still have back on page 1 on your map, Galatians, this whole area that Paul has traveled through, Paul and Barnabas have traveled through, is called what? Galatia. Right? That's the bigger name, Galatia, the location of the Gauls that came over from more of southern Europe. But Paul writes, so the book of Galatians now applies, right? Can you hear these people in Pamphylia and Pisidia and Antioch and Lystra and Derbe, and they get the letter of Galatians? Yeah, I know that guy, right? He was just here, right? Just a few months ago, right? Remember when we stoned him? Right? I thought we did. Yeah. Right? So, and maybe some of those people, kind of like the Aucca Indians in Ecuador back in the late 50s, remember when the five missionary men were killed and some of those who killed them came to trust Christ? Right? So, there's a lot going on, and Luke doesn't have to tell us everything that's going on. Right, he just assumes, because Theophilus apparently doesn't need to know that, you know, Luke doesn't say, insert the book of James, insert Galatians. He doesn't have to do that. Okay, but we know that James and Galatians are early letters and are significant letters, but that would help you understand some of the things that are going on in the churches of Galatia that Paul and Barnabas have just visited. Okay, so that's why Galatians is such a vital book, because you're dealing with Gentiles who are hearing the gospel, the Christian gospel, from Jewish believers. Right? And that whole issue of where do Jews and Gentiles fit into this program of God's grace and God's and the doctrine of salvation, but also the doctrine of sanctification. Having begun by the Spirit, do you think you can be made mature by the flesh? No, you need the Spirit of God for sanctification as well. So those are things that they were struggling with. And I would argue in the book of Galatians, by the way, I think it stands that look at the pronouns that Paul uses in the book of Galatians. Again, it's not 100%, but if you follow the pronouns when he says you and us, those are significant, not just for your duh reasons, but I think the yous that he's referring to there are normally Gentiles. The us, the we, the our, is referring to Jewish believers. And I think as you go through the book of Galatians, that helps you understand, for instance, we have time. Let's go to Galatians real quick, where he says, in chapter 4, just chapter 4, verse 1. Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is the owner of everything. His point being that there's a distinction between a son or a legal heir and a slave. However, when you look at them when they're young, you say, well, there's not much difference. In fact, the owner of everything, the potential owner of all things, is under guardians and stewards until the date set by the father, right? The father determines those things. He determines when a boy will become the legal heir. That's what a will is for, right? It's all part of that setup. So also we, while we were children, we were enslaved under the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we, who were under the law, might receive the adoption as sons. And because you are sons, like, whoa, so Jews and Gentiles are equally the sons of God? Yeah, that's a big deal, right? We are all legal heirs of God. Because you are sons, God sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but also a son, and if a son, then an heir through God. However, at that time, when you did not know God, in other words, you were Gentiles. Now, you had lots of gods and goddesses, but you did not know God. You were slaves to those which by nature are no gods. But now, having known God, and notice how Paul corrects his own wording here, or rather, having been known by God, right? Just make sure we get this correct. How is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you want to be enslaved all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I labored over you for nothing. Acts 13 and Acts 14. I got stoned for nothing. Right? So I we need to stop there. But you go through and work through this. I think the yous and the us's are and the we's are significant. I do know years ago I taught on that, and somebody came up to me afterwards bragging how they spent the entire Sunday afternoon teaching their children that pastor was wrong on his theory on the book of Galatians. But I don't think you need to do that. I don't think that's helpful to your kids. However, as I said, I don't think it's a 100% working through that, but I think there are numerous places throughout there that he's saying, you Gentiles, we or us Jews, and understand that contrast through there.